Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight. A harsh reality. The winter storm gripping much of the country leaves many without power and hits Texas especially hard. Then, a staggering toll. COVID-19 causes a sharp decrease in average life expectancy in the U.S., but an even larger drop for communities of color. And work shift. The ever-increasing focus on college education and a disdain for manual labor create a serious dearth of skilled tradespeople.
There are entire categories of work that are shrouded in mystery. And if we don't destigmatize them, we're going to be waiting for plumbers and electricians for a long, long time.
All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. A huge storm system has shifted east tonight after brutalizing the United States midsection. It's leaving at least 40 dead, plus a legacy of mangled power grids, broken water systems, and political fallout. Stephanie Tsai reports on this day's developments.
New misery for a new part of the country. The Arctic front that pummeled the central and southern parts of the U.S. pushed into the northeast today. In New Jersey, Governor Phil Murphy urged people to be alert.
It's a long time-wise storm. This goes deep into tomorrow. So keep your wits about you. Do the right thing. Stay home if you can.
Heavy snow blanketed the region, with the most accumulation in parts of the Mid-Atlantic and Appalachia. In its wake, the storm left a wintry mess that's already stretched for days in Texas.
When people are making comparisons like, oh, Texas is shutting down for, you know, 3 inches of snow, you guys just have no idea what's really going on.
High school teacher Alicia Hinkle and her mom Juanita, who live in a suburb of Dallas, are just two of the many Texans scrambling to keep warm and fed amid ongoing power and water outages.
That was the struggle. So the first morning, we do not have a gas stovetop. So we had to, I wrapped some potatoes. My mom was laughing at me and I just kind of put them in the fireplace. You end up going to, without me, gas station.
So went to Large Bucky's just north of Corinth. And we were able to get a couple of sandwiches. So we did that.
Gas station sandwiches.
Yes.
We've been eating gas station sandwiches.
I'm sure a lot.
Juanita and her husband set up camp by the fireplace, but by midweek, it wasn't keeping them warm enough. And they all moved in with Alicia's sister at her house near Dallas.
Many people rely on the busing system and, you know, the train system that we may have in the Dallas Metroplex. And just getting out to it, just having to kind of lug what you can, finding these warming stations that may be available. It just seems easier when you think about infrastructures in other states that are used to this.
Power is finally being restored for millions of Texas residents. The numbers still facing outages fell below 500,000 today. Officials from ERCOT, which manages the Texas power grid, said that while the weather could yet bring more transmission trouble, they hope to reduce the number of forced outages.
We would expect that any outages like that would be limited, and we would be able to rotate them as opposed to these more extended outages if they're required. And we're certainly going to try to avoid that.
The nonprofit grid operator and other state officials have come under fire for not doing enough to prepare for the cold conditions, including from the mayor of Dallas, Eric Johnson.
Our people are suffering right now, and we don't have control over the power grid. We rely on it, but we don't have any control over it. Those who do have control over it, the ERCOT, which oversees the grid, and starting at the very top, those folks need to look at what happened, figure out who's responsible, and then changes need to be made.
Texans are facing another unfolding crisis, obtaining drinkable water. About 13 million people in a number of cities were under boil water notices today.
How can we boil water? We don't even have power.
Frigid temperatures this week have damaged water systems throughout the state and frozen pipes. In Houston, people lined up at a water faucet in this park to fill up buckets, while others collected rainwater and melted snow. As our reporting has showed, the storms and the after effects have hit vulnerable groups the hardest, especially communities of color. Dr. Robert Bullard is a professor at Texas Southern University. He focuses on wealth and racial disparities related to the environment, and he joins me now from Sugar Land, Texas. Professor Bullard, it's a pleasure to have you on the NewsHour. Tell me what folks in your area have been going through in recent days. What are they lacking?
Well, first of all, I think it's important to understand that this blackout in terms of loss of power is more than just about energy. It's also about those communities that were struggling before the storm in terms of struggling with energy insecurity. And this storm has really shown a spotlight on those disparities in terms of communities that don't have not only electricity, but no water, no transportation, private cars to get to the grocery stores to buy food and water. And the same communities are devastated because of health disparities. A lot of asthma, a lot of diabetes, and people on dialysis machines that they can't operate their medical equipment without electricity. So it poses really a great danger, more than just being cold.
So what you're saying is that even as we look at still hundreds of thousands of people in Texas that are going without power for multiple days, that there were communities there that already didn't have consistent power?
Well, because of the fact that a lot of low-income families have problems paying electric bills, low-income communities and people of color generally pay a larger percentage of their household budgets toward energy, heating in the winter and cooling in the summer. And so anytime you get a spike in a utility bill, in some cases may double, that creates a big problem. And again, these are issues that low-income families have to deal with in major disasters, whether it's a hurricane or a flood, or in this case, we're talking power outage.
When you think about climate change and its impacts on people, why is it important to focus on these communities of color and these existing disparities?
Well, I think when we talk about climate change really has to be looked at more than greenhouse gases and parts per million. We have to talk about the inequities that exist in our society that make certain communities more vulnerable because of where they live, their spatial location in terms of low-lying areas, areas that are prone to flooding, areas that are urban heat islands because of no lack of trees, green canopy, and all of those kinds of things. And so it's really important that we plan for making sure that our climate action plans are resilient and will protect the most vulnerable. When we don't do that, we basically will plan for leaving certain populations behind on the other side of the levee or in the flood zones or in the heat islands. And in this case, without power and people whose lights go out first and who are the last one to get power back. That's the inequity that we must address when we deal with climate plans and plans for dealing with a just energy transition.
As far, Professor, as what folks in your area and throughout the state of Texas are facing right at this moment in the midst of a winter storm, have you seen any evidence that communities of color are experiencing, for example, power outages at a greater rate than other communities?
What we find is that this area has been hit hard by the outages. But if you talk about the areas that have experienced the most devastating impact is one thing for, like, I was out of power for 2 days. My lights came back on. But it's different for me than it is for a low-income family that have lots of people in the household. They're dealing with COVID. They're dealing with the fact that you don't have power. Now we have boil water advisory, which means you can't wash your hands. You can't social distance. And so the impacts that would occur for low-income families will be different than another family that has means. These are issues that are cascading, that are created by this power outage, and to a large extent, people are just looking at the outage, these rolling blackouts. But for many communities, it's more than just the blackout. It's all these other issues and challenges and disparities that come to the front.
Dr. Robert Buller, I can't thank you enough for coming on the program and discussing these ongoing issues. Thank you.
My pleasure.
In the day's other news, stark new numbers put the human toll of COVID-19 in vivid relief. The total number of lives lost to the coronavirus in the United States passed 492,000. And the CDC reported that average U.S. life expectancy dropped by a full year during the first half of 2020 due to the pandemic. That is the biggest decline since World War II. We'll get details after the news summary. NASA's rover Perseverance is on the surface of the planet Mars tonight after a journey of 7 months. It streaked across the Martian sky, as depicted in this animation, slowing from 12,000 miles an hour. Then the robot craft deployed parachutes, and a rocket-powered crane lowered it to the surface. That triggered the all-important signal to mission control.
Touchdown confirmed. Perseverance safely on the surface of Mars, ready to begin seeking the sands of past life.
Within minutes, the rover sent back this first image of its landing site, a crater in an ancient river delta. We'll return to this mission to Mars a little later in the program. Congressional Democrats formally introduced President Biden's immigration bill today. It lays out paths to citizenship for some 11 million migrants in the U.S. who are without legal status. Republicans have signaled opposition, partly because they want new border security measures. Also today, the Biden administration laid out guidelines for more targeted immigration enforcement than during the Trump era. The U.S. State Department has announced that the U.S. will agree to talk with Iran if the European Union invites all parties to the 2015 nuclear deal. The Biden administration previously had said that Iran must first return to compliance with the deal. President Trump withdrew the U.S. from the agreement in 2018. Crowds were back out in cities across Myanmar today, protesting a military coup. They defied police who assaulted striking rail workers in Mandalay overnight. Thousands of people in Yangon carried flags and blocked roads. Their goal was to obstruct military movements and prevent government employees from getting to work. In northern India, thousands of farmers staged sit-ins at railroad stations, escalating a months-long campaign against new agricultural laws. Demonstrators blocked trains for hours by sitting and chanting on tracks as thousands of security officers turned out. The protesters insisted they won't stop.
Farmers have decided that the struggle to get these three laws repealed is connected to our lives, connected to our future, connected to our children, and connected to our daily bread. Either we will survive and our assets will survive, or the country won't be able to get by, as they will not get anything to eat.
Farmers say that the new laws will drastically cut their incomes. The Indian government says the measures are essential to modernize the country's agriculture system. Back in this country, the Labor Department reported new claims for unemployment benefits shot back over 860,000 last week as COVID-19 disruptions escalated. And Vice President Kamala Harris warned that women leaving the workforce during the pandemic has become a national emergency. Some 2.5 million women have stopped looking for work, far more than the number of men. And the percentage of women in the labor force is the lowest since 1988. The war over GameStop headlined a U.S. congressional hearing today. Last month, small investors and hedge funds battled for days over the video game retailer and roiled the broader market. Today, the head of the trading platform Robinhood apologized for stopping trading in GameStop at one point, but he denied that hedge funds influenced the decision. And on Wall Street today, a combination of lower energy prices and higher interest rates on bonds sent stocks down. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 119 points to close at 31,493. The NASDAQ fell 100 points, and the S&P 500 shed 17. Still to come on the NewsHour, the pandemic causes a sharp decrease in life expectancy for communities of color. A deadly South African COVID variant strikes fear around the world. Several states put forward new restrictive abortion legislation, and much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington, and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
The toll of the pandemic is highlighted in stark terms again today. A government report finds that expected lifespans fell in this country by a year on average in the first half of 2020. That is the largest drop since World War II. Overdoses, heart attacks, and other illnesses are part of that. But researchers say the pandemic undoubtedly is a major factor. Moreover, the gaps along racial lines are profound. White life expectancy fell by about 8 months, while Black Americans lost 2.7 years of average life expectancy. Among Latinos, life expectancy dropped by nearly 2 years. And these numbers are even larger among men. Experts say that this points to major socioeconomic disparities, and we're going to focus on that tonight. Dr. Reed Tuckson is a former commissioner of public health here in Washington, D.C., who now has his own firm. He's one of the leaders of the Black Coalition Against COVID-19. Dr. Tuckson, thank you very much for joining us tonight. We appreciate it. First of all, overall, as you look at these numbers broadly, are they surprising?
They are not surprising. We have known and experienced this excess exposure of African Americans to the COVID pandemic. We knew that we were dying two times more often than the rest of the country and being hospitalized three times more. So it is not surprising. However, it still does not dim the sadness, the pain, the heartache that comes with looking at these quantitative numbers that are really describing in mathematical ways the feelings and emotions that we've had all along.
So when you see, Dr. Tuckson, as you mentioned, Black Americans, the average drop life expectancy three times that what it is for white Americans. Among Latinos, it's two times the drop that it is for white Americans. Why is this?
Well, we know, first of all, that African Americans are exposed to this virus more often than other people because of the nature of the jobs that we have, that so many of us are the ones on the front lines in running our buses and subways, in the retail industry, the ones cleaning our streets. We are the ones who are more often unable to practice make our livelihood by being at home and working online. So we're much more exposed. Number two, the conditions under which so many African Americans live make it very difficult to fight off this COVID pandemic. We are often and more often living in crowded housing with multi-generational families. We have much less opportunity to do the social distancing that we wanted to have done. And then third and finally, a major element is that pre-existing, we were suffering from pre-existing chronic health issues, more heart disease, more lung disease, more diabetes, more obesity. And all of those, as we have learned from the beginning of the pandemic, predispose to poorer outcomes when you are finally infected with the COVID-19 virus.
It's so interesting that a number of the things you're discussing are parallel to what we heard from Dr. Bullard a few minutes ago in discussing why communities of color are disproportionately affected by these terrible winter storms and the conditions that come from them. But Dr. Tuckson, what about just in terms of health care services and what is available and what isn't in communities of color?
Well, first of all, I think it is very important to go back to the point that you're making about Dr. Ballard and the comments that he made. Remember that health is the place where all of the social forces converge to express themselves with the greatest clarity and the most importance. Health is where everything comes together. So when we think about the health outcomes of people of color, it's not just medical care. It is very much the social determinants that lead to health outcomes: housing, economic instability, education, challenging access to healthy foods, community environments that are filled with stress and are not safe. And then we come to the quality of care. And that point is very important. We have known now for 20 years, since the publication of a major National Academy of Medicine study called Unequal Treatment, that the delivery of health care to people of color is suboptimal compared to white America for a variety of reasons. And so this is a long-standing challenge that unfortunately the healthcare industry has yet to be able to fully and adequately address.
And I think part of what is so striking, and I was looking at the numbers this afternoon, is that among Black Americans, life expectancy had actually been improving. It had been increasing in the last couple of decades. So this is a really stark turn in the direction of where we want to see these numbers go. Does it tell you, I mean, we all know the country was caught off guard, was not prepared for this pandemic. Do you believe there are going to be clear lessons we can learn, we can do something with coming out of this pandemic?
I hope so. And I hope the first lesson that we learn, and this pandemic has shown such a bright light, is that each of us as individuals live in the context of a community of other people. So that when we choose as individuals to exert a right not to wear a mask and don't care that we could easily sicken or cause someone else to die, that is a major issue now of an ethical and moral nature in front of the society. If we have learned anything, it is that we have to begin to focus our attention on empathy and love, a concern and caring for everyone. For Black people, this is particularly important because we now realize that Black people have, because of a history of deeply planted seeds of distrust, and those seeds being watered every day by our experience in living our lives in American society, that distrust leads to very negative behaviors. It leads us to make decisions sometimes that are contrary to our best interests. And so now we know that as we go forward, that we've learned the lesson that we have to bond together. And certainly the health enterprise, the researchers, the clinicians, and the health policy experts have got to come together now and try to do everything we can with the rest of our society to overcome this distrust, because this distrust is not just an idle emotion. Distrust leads to death. And then finally, I think what this does is to focus everyone's attention on getting at these structural racism issues, these social determinants of health that were always present in creating excess experiences with disease and death. But now we know what it does for a pandemic like COVID-19. And hopefully it will now regenerate a much greater focus on getting at these root and fundamental causes.
Well, it is certainly something that we at the NewsHour are committed to continue to cover. And again, so stark, seeing these numbers over just the first half of 2020, seeing the life expectancy change, incredibly discouraging. Dr. Reed Tuckson, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And now to South Africa, which has been battling to contain a mutant strain of COVID-19. that studies now show renders two types of vaccines from Pfizer and Moderna 60% less effective. The strain has now been found in more than 30 other countries, including here in the United States, prompting travel bans. But as special correspondent Chris Ochamringa tells us, across Africa itself, borders remain very much open, and there's little hope of getting enough vaccines for years to come.
Grave diggers find little rest in this cemetery in the port city of Cape Town. South Africa has recorded more than 46,000 COVID-19 deaths since the pandemic began, the highest number on the continent. And the toll continues to rise after the discovery of a new variant. Dr. Richard Mihigo of the World Health Organization.
WHO, we're taking this quite very seriously because from some preliminary data that are starting to emerge, it's clearly showing that the new variant is the force behind the new wave that we are seeing in many countries.
The spread of the new variant has prompted a raft of countries, including the US, to ban travel from South Africa. The UK has gone a step further, banning new arrivals from the Democratic Republic of Congo and Tanzania, amid fears the mutant strain is spreading rapidly there. At least 20 other countries, including the US, have also found cases. And while travel bans shutting South Africans out may help, borders remain open across Africa. That leaves countries like the DRC and others that are still open to flights from the rest of Africa vulnerable. And according to health officials like Dr. Kalubi Mulamba, the DRC has seen a spike in infections over the last 5 months.
The second bug of COVID, when it came, we have received many patients. When we can try to compare the first and the second, we can say that now we have received more patients than before.
Health experts here believe the rise in cases may be caused by a completely new variant.
We are still analyzing the samples, so it's possible that this variant is already in the country.
Identifying which variants are prevalent across the world is key to containing the virus. In that effort, the WHO and the Africa Centers for Disease Control and Prevention have set up COVID-19 genomic sequencing laboratories in the DRC and other African countries to help boost their capacity to detect the new variants.
We are, for the moment, asking countries to ship to these regional reference laboratory a minimum of at least 20 specimens of the virus so that we can be able to establish the circulation of the new variant as it has been detected in South Africa, but also in other several countries in Africa.
But the fact that people haven't stopped traveling among African countries, including migrant laborers and business people, means there is very little way of knowing how far the variant first found in South Africa is spreading across the continent. This Congolese family in the capital Kinshasa has a home in South Africa, and they're determined not to let the pandemic wreck their ability to travel back and forth.
I think it's a matter of taking responsibility, the sanitary measures. I'm not too worried about it as long as I stick to what I've got to do. You know, put on the mask, have your sanitizer. It's a wave, it's gonna come and go, so you just got to protect yourself.
We apply those measures and we are safe, so I trust them and I'm willing to travel because I have to go and visit my family. Yeah.
Not everyone is as relaxed. Some African countries like Nigeria are doubling down in their efforts to contain the new variants with quarantine rules for people coming from countries where they're prevalent. Still, borders remain open, increasing Africa's vulnerability in the absence of a meaningful vaccine rollout across the continent. South Africa, which was on the cusp of starting its mass vaccination program, suddenly and controversially paused the rollout of the AstraZeneca vaccine. Reports suggest the vaccine may offer only minimal protection against mild disease in young people caused by the variant. The research indicates that nevertheless, the vaccine does protect against serious disease, hospitalization, and death. And meanwhile, South Africa has announced plans to use the Johnson & Johnson single-shot vaccine instead. How South Africa recovers from stalling the start of its vaccine program is unclear. Even so, it's made more progress with vaccinations than some other African countries, where vaccine skepticism is compounding the problem. Tanzania's president doubts their efficacy entirely.
We Tanzanians must be very careful about receiving medical supplies from abroad. I am asking the health ministry not to be too quick to accept any vaccine without ascertaining its efficacy.
As researchers investigate ways to modify COVID-19 vaccines to tackle the variant originally discovered in South Africa, the Africa CDC has warned about rising fatality rates across the continent.
And with more than 3.5 million coronavirus cases already reported in Africa, the continent is only now beginning to receive the first arrivals of COVID-19 vaccines on a wider scale. But the reality is there won't be enough vaccines for potentially years to come. And as borders remain open, the question remains, what's Africa's way out of the pandemic? For the PBS NewsHour, I am Chris Ochamringa in the Democratic Republic of Congo.
And today, in an effort to start helping to find that way out, the Biden administration announced that it would support a global push to distribute COVID vaccines equitably. It added $2 billion for the effort to ensure vaccine availability, adding to the $2 billion authorized by Congress last year. South Carolina is the latest state to place tough new restrictions on abortions. It is part of a renewed focus on abortion access with a new conservative majority on the Supreme Court. John Yang has the story.
Judy, the bill that South Carolina Governor Henry McMaster signed today bans abortions after 8 weeks of pregnancy if a fetal heartbeat is detected. The only exceptions are rape, incest, and to protect the health of the mother. Nearly a dozen other states have passed similar laws, but all have been blocked by the courts, and Planned Parenthood has already sued to block this one. But at the signing ceremony, McMaster predicted that anti-abortion forces would prevail.
If there is not a right to life, then what life is there? What rights exist, if not the elementary, fundamental, profound right to life? So we are here to protect that. And this step we take today was long in coming and monumental in consequence. But our battles are not over. Yet I believe that the dawn of victory is upon us.
The state legislatures across the country have increasingly become the front lines of the struggle in the debate over abortion. Gavin Jackson is a public affairs reporter for South Carolina ETV, which is a network of PBS stations in South Carolina. And Mary Ziegler is a Florida State University law professor. She's the author of Abortion and the Law in America, Roe v. Wade to the Present. Thank you both for joining us. Gavin, let me start with you. It sounds like it was a wild and woolly session yesterday when the House finally passed this bill. What was it like? Give us a sense of what it was like in the chamber.
Well, it was definitely a unique day in the chamber, but I first want to start how we got here, John, and that's been, we're 6 weeks now into our legislative session. This bill has been zooming through the General Assembly. It was the first bill introduced in the Senate, first bill filed in the Senate, and then had multiple hearings, got right through the committee process, got on the Senate floor, and headed right over to the House, where they also had the same kind of committee process, got through that really quickly. And the whole key here, too, in the House was not to amend this bill. Lawmakers wanted to get this to the governor's desk as soon as possible. So we did see some contentiousness on the floor yesterday among some Republicans, actually one Republican lawmaker, a fringe Republican lawmaker, who got a little upset because he wasn't able to file any amendments to this bill that would take out the exceptions for race, or about rape and incest, because a lot of Republican lawmakers want to go a little bit further with this bill, but of course they wouldn't have had the support to do that. So this was kind of the compromise, and you heard from the governor there in that clip saying, hey, this is the first step. We can keep going forward. Of course, this step is still kind of pending, depending on what's going on in the courts at this point. As you said, there's already a court challenge in place. So while abortions are halted right now temporarily in the state, that could The injunction could be granted as soon as tomorrow afternoon.
This is not the first time that South Carolina lawmakers have tried to pass this bill. What was the difference this time? And do the lawmakers see themselves as part of a national push, a national drive against abortion?
Yeah, John, this was, it's no big secret about lawmakers here in South Carolina wanting to get this to the Supreme Court. Unfortunately, we're behind a few states with laws already going to the Supreme Court for challenge. I think we're the first one in the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals to try and get one to the Supreme Court. But again, several other states, including Georgia, passing a similar bill like this to go to the Supreme Court. But right now, it was really trying to make good on some campaign promises. We did see Republicans pick up seats in the Senate and the House. Last November, we saw lawmakers really wanting to make a big splash. We have the governor up for re-election next year. All this comes into a good storm of them uniting essentially behind a major legislative victory, which is the abortion ban. And that's something that, you know, we might be seeing a lot of things going on at the national level with the future of the Republican Party. In South Carolina, the Republican Party is united behind what just took place today in South Carolina.
Mary Ziegler, let's talk a little bit about that national picture. How place this South Carolina law in context for us in terms of restrictiveness in the other state laws that are being passed or being pushed right now?
Well, I think South Carolina lawmakers were trying to push this as being a kind of new generation of heartbeat bill, a more kind of moderate bill, if you will. It's an example of what we think of as extreme changing in some states, right? I mean, heartbeat bills of any kind would have been seen as pretty out there, and were seen that way in 2019. And now versions of a heartbeat bill, albeit with some of the exceptions you outlined, John, are now being framed by lawmakers as normal. And that's partly because the entire spectrum of abortion legislation has changed pretty radically. So we've seen a bill proposed in Arizona that would sentence, for example, women as well as doctors involved in abortions to make them face murder charges and potentially even subject them to the death penalty, given that first-degree murder is death eligible in Arizona. So this, I would still qualify heartbeat bills as more sort of absolute in the grand scheme of things, but the more lawmakers embrace this strategy, the more what we would view as absolute or extreme laws changes. And so that's something that I think South Carolina lawmakers have very consciously done to say this is a sort of new generation heartbeat bill that isn't as extreme, but it speaks more to the fact that what we think of as extreme in this debate is changing.
Is the what we think of extreme in this debate changing because the court has changed? We now have three justices nominated by Donald Trump, who have all had things to say about abortion?
I think that's certainly what lawmakers are responding to. There was a sense in which it was almost futile introducing a bill like this, even probably after Brett Kavanaugh joined the court, simply because that was asking the court not only to overrule Roe, but to do so pretty expeditiously and in a fairly flashy way. And I think now state lawmakers are betting that among President Trump's three Supreme Court nominees, there are at least enough to get to that magical five votes that would result in the overturning of Roe. I think it goes beyond that, though, because I think the anti-abortion movement, much like the Republican Party, is divided. There's a sort of anti-abortion establishment, much like there's a GOP establishment, and there's an insurgent wing of the anti-abortion movement. A lot of those folks have been behind the heartbeat bills and some of the more extreme legislation we're seeing. And just as that wing of the GOP has ascended, I think that wing of the anti-abortion movement is baking a bid for control, too. And that wing of the movement has connections in places like South Carolina, and we're seeing the consequences of that play out now.
There is a restrictive abortion law from Mississippi that would ban abortions after 15 weeks of pregnancy. That has been a request for the Supreme Court to hear it has been pending since October. I think there were a lot of observers who thought that that this new court would take it fairly quickly. What is it possible to say what this delay means with the fact that they have not taken it yet?
It's hard to say. So ordinarily, if the court had started meeting about the case in October and still hadn't made a decision, we would conclude that the court was likely not going to take the case and that there was some justice angry about that fact. So, you know, you could imagine Clarence Thomas, for example, writing an angry opinion dissenting from the court's decision not to take the case. What makes this harder to read is that part of the delay stemmed from the fact that the court just kept rescheduling this and not meeting about it at all. And we don't really know why that was. There are different theories. It could be all of the kind of election challenges President Trump was generating. It could be COVID. It could be that the court just isn't sure where to go on abortion, right? I mean, we have the great mystery in this is what kinds of conservative do we have on the Supreme Court? We have a one wing in Clarence Thomas and Samuel Alito who seem quite willing to get rid of Roe quickly. We have Chief Justice John Roberts who seems to want to take a more cautious approach. And we quite simply don't know where the other three justices are going to land. And the court's kind of hesitation to go one way or another on this Mississippi case is kind of deepening the mystery.
Mary Ziegler from Florida State University, Gavin Jackson, South Carolina, ETV. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having us.
The U.S. is back on the red planet tonight. After a nearly 300 million mile journey, NASA celebrated late this afternoon when it landed its latest rover on Mars. There's lots of excitement around NASA's most ambitious Mars project yet. The rover is designed to explore new areas of the planet and look for clues to signs of past life there. Just so you know, the temperature on Mars is a cool 81 degrees below zero. Our Miles O'Brien has been watching it all closely, and he's with me now. Hello again, Miles. So I was excited watching the video feed from NASA. Were you on the edge of your seat?
Always, always, Judy. You know, it's always a great moment of joy when it happens. The team is so good, they make it look easy. But I guess I should remind everyone, this is, in fact, rocket science. It's extremely hard what they did. NASA now is 5 for 5 in attempting to land rovers on the red planet. This one, about the size of an SUV, all kinds of capability, nuclear powered, and threaded a needle in a very rugged part of Mars. The scientists like the rugged part. The engineers responsible for getting it on the ground safely would prefer a veritable parking lot. So there's always a struggle, but they had some new technology this go round, a radar system, some imagery, which allowed them to pretty much do a bullseye in a rugged part of the planet. So we're off to the races on Mars once again, Judy.
Threaded a needle. Well, that gives us a sense of how hard it was. So, Miles, remind us what this is all about. We know it's looking eventually for some form of life that existed billions of years ago, but help us understand what it is.
Yeah, I mean, basically, if you look back to Pathfinder back in 1997, which demonstrated we could get there safely, and then the Opportunity and Spirit rovers in 2003, Curiosity 2012. We've steadily been homing in on, first of all, locations where there was water, they believe, the scientists confirmed that, then found places which not only had water, but had the habitable environment billions of years ago. And now they're in a place where they think there's a reasonable shot at finding the remnants of organic material, biologic organic material. The rocks that are the age where Perseverance is right now, the Jezero crater, we have rocks about the same age in Western Australia. And they have all kinds of evidence left over, very distinct evidence of organic biological life. And Perseverance will be trucking through this region. And if it sees things that look like Western Australia, you can bet the scientists are going to get pretty excited.
So, Miles, again, 300 million miles away. How hard is what they are trying to do now? Not only to do it, but then get it back here.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. This is the first stage of a very ambitious, long sought after idea for NASA, a sample return mission. So Perseverance will go along, find some interesting samples. It will do some science on board, but as capable as this rover is, it's still kind of limited how much you can do remotely on the surface of Mars, all packed into a tiny rover. So ultimately what it will do is drop a couple of dozen samples on the surface. And in a few years to come, in partnership with the Europeans, a retriever rover will come to Mars and conduct, basically an Easter egg hunt for the samples, pick them up, They get launched back to Earth, and by the 2030s, we'll have samples of Mars bedrock back on Earth, which will allow scientists to tease out the nuance of all this. These organics are not smoking gun or easy, and so having them in an Earthbound lab will be helpful.
Well, in the 2030s, you know what your assignment's going to be, Miles. You're going to be reporting on that.
We'll see you then. And we'll see you then, Judy, for sure.
For sure. Miles O'Brien, thank you as always.
You're welcome, Judy.
Jobless claims were high again this past week. More than 860,000 people filed claims. Millions of people are still looking for work. But some employers say they can't find enough skilled workers for certain jobs. That is due in part, they say, to stigmas that need to change. Paul Solman has the story for our series, Work Shift, which focuses on navigating the job market in a post-COVID economy.
Get ready.
Get ready. Get ready.
Mike Rowe, man on a mission.
To get dirty.
To get dirty.
For years on the Discovery Channel, Rowe was America's hands-on evangelist for dirty jobs.
I am so sorry.
Paving a road.
You're not, but you're flattening.
Replacing an oil filter on a wind turbine.
Now that's a nasty, nasty, nasty little job.
After years of romanticizing the unromantic,
it's all about the glamour.
Rowe put money where his body was. The Mike Rowe Works Foundation, which has awarded about 1,000 scholarships totaling $5 million so far.
Typically, what we do is pay the fee that is due to a trade school or an apprenticeship program or sometimes a community college.
Rowe has to evangelize because fewer kids than ever believe in dirty jobs.
Before COVID, there were 7.3 million open jobs, the majority of which didn't require a four-year degree.
Seattle plumbing contractor Vinny Spazzari.
Working outside in the cold and the rain, crawling under houses, those are the things we as plumbers do. Kids these days, they don't want to put the effort in to get there.
So we're going
to
come up, through, and then down.
But in a low-wage, heavy economy, plumbing apprenticeships start at close to $20 an hour nowadays. And after just a few years and a license, top earners can make $70,000 and up. Unfortunately, dirty jobs have had an increasingly bad image, says Mike Rowe, and he thinks he knows why.
The push for one form of education, in my view, really was the beginning of a long list of stigmas and stereotypes and myths and misperceptions that to this day dissuade millions of kids from pursuing a legitimate opportunity to make six figures in the trades.
The culprit, in his view, the supposed cachet of college.
In the eyes of many parents and in the eyes of many counselors, the trade school was the thing you did if you weren't cut out for university.
How many of you would seriously consider a career in one of the trades?
A high school class in industrial Lake Charles, Louisiana, anchor of Calcasieu Parish, which President Trump carried by better than 2-1. How many of these kids would consider a future in the trades?
Just one.
That one is Jacob Brewster, who loves woodworking, and yet he feels the pressure.
It's like, go to college, go to college. There's barely anybody saying, go to trade school, you know?
Not saying it to the 15% of kids who drop out of high school before graduating, nor to the additional 50% plus who don't finish college. Trade school, as post-secondary education, can be a ticket to a six-figure income, but it's sneered at by kids, parents, and teachers alike.
That's not an option that's often presented to us. Like, this is not for you.
At least here, there is somewhat of a stigma if you don't go into college.
I, you know, have to go to college or I'm nothing, you know?
I think the stigma is real.
Brenda DeFelice has taught in Southwest Louisiana for 30 years.
Because we have so much industry, and we do have a lot of very successful tradespeople here who make a lot of money. I think in our area, it's less so, but it's still there.
Atlanta electrician Tanya Hicks sees the same bias in her community, even though unemployment is famously much higher for African Americans.
After the civil rights movement, a lot of African American children were encouraged to go to college instead. Sometimes in the African American culture, blue collar workers are looked down on or like they're less than if you do not have a college degree.
In fact, college grads earn 74% more than those with only a high school diploma, but not that much more than skilled tradespeople. Median income of $54,000 a year for a bachelor's degree versus $51,000 for electricians, $46,000 for plumbers. Although tradespeople may have somewhat shorter careers. But regardless, Mike Rowe says, there's a disconnect.
If you look at the way colleges have been able to raise their tuitions, and if you look at the speed with which the skills gap has widened, and if you look at the number of kids who are out there, well-educated, but hopelessly in debt, and not trained for a multitude of good jobs that actually exist, you begin to see the degree to which we're disconnected.
But as an economist might ask, or a Buddhist, what do you mean by a good job?
I have nothing against people that want to go to college. However, they can't find a job, and now they're just in just this insurmountable debt.
Michael Barbosa, now 26, had a scholarship to attend college, but dropped out.
I worked as a barista and a grocery store clerk for minimum wage. It was really hard to get by. The only way to really get by was to work a lot of hours and multiple jobs.
But on one of them, working in construction supply, he had his epiphany.
When I was doing my drywall stocking, I ran into a lot of plumbers, and they would ask me, why are you just drywall stocking? He says, don't you want to learn a trade?
There is so much hands-on work.
Barbosa is now training to be a plumber and being paid $16 an hour to learn. Daniel Stanky finished the same program, is now an apprentice plumber.
Both my parents went and graduated from college. My original plan was to become a history teacher. About halfway through, though, I fell out of love with that idea, kind of started looking around at other opportunities potentially.
His boss says he'll make six figures this year. And then there are those few like Sarah Schnabel, who graduated with a math degree from Ivy League Cornell.
Growing up, it was always like, oh, you went to the trade school because you didn't do well in school. I still get comments from my family like, why are you doing this?
She now works with electrician Brian Lamort, who graduated from Towson University in Maryland with a computer degree.
In college, would you have thought that you would become an electrician?
No.
Why not?
At that point, I figured I'm training myself to go out and work for some big company and be a systems analyst or something like that. But in reality, I eventually came to find you can become replaced very easily. You can become very comfortable and then become obsolete very fast in the tech world.
Look, says Mike Rowe.
A liberal arts education is not the enemy. I've got one. It served me well. But there are entire categories of work that are shrouded in mystery. And if we don't demystify them and destigmatize them, we're going to be waiting for plumbers and electricians for a long, long time.
Is the gap closing? Is the stigma beginning to dissolve or no?
I think it is. And perversely, I think COVID might have something to do with it. I'm sure you've noticed there's a new word that's really been injected into the lexicon, essential.
Which is, in fact, just how Vinny Spazzari's plumbing apprentices feel.
Sometimes you're just people's heroes, especially if they've been in a bad spot for a couple days.
They actually have called me heroes. It's just great, you know?
I can't tell you the amount of pride from people in our industry, how we felt that we needed to keep the country going. And we have the jobs of the future for sustainability and energy and water conservation.
As you can tell from the music, I'm about to wrap things up.
So all of which makes Mike Rowe think, or maybe hope.
And when things get back to normal, this country is going to enter a new age of work, a new age of making things and fixing things and building things, an age where skilled workers are going to be in demand like never before.
We'll see. For the PBS NewsHour, Paul Solman.
Such a great report. Thank you. And on the NewsHour online right now, as millions in Texas go without reliable electricity, heat, and water, groups around the state are working to help the most vulnerable. You can find ways to support their efforts on our website, pbs.org/newshour. And that is the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. Join us online and again here tomorrow evening for all of us at the PBS NewsHour. Thank you. Please stay safe, and we'll see you soon.